ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This will had come about in the most suspicious circumstances you could possibly imagine.
Who gets what when someone dies, and who decides?
The difficulty with undue influence often is proving it.
Join me, Damien Carrick, for the Law Report special series on wills, Over My Dead Body.
The person felt like they had no option. It's difficult to prove that.
To hear, search for The Law Report and look out for Over My Dead Body. Find it on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
What Australian books do you treasure, grapple with, value or reread? Those that changed you or shaped you. Books you loved in the past but can't open anymore, but still want to acknowledge in some way. Hello, it's Kate Evans here for ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. And with voting for the 2026 ABC Radio National Top 100 Australian Books Countdown opening on Monday the 31st of August, we want you to start thinking about your top 10. And to help, we're bringing you inspiration in the form of a special edition of The Bookshelf recorded at the recent Byron Writers Festival. So there's me, Cassie McCullough, and we were joined on stage by award-winning writers Trent Dalton, Claire Thomas and Steve Minon, with a surprise appearance from a Miles Franklin shortlisted author too, not to mention an opinionated crow. So let's head to a marquee at Byron Writers Festival.
Hello and welcome to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf here at the Byron Bay Writers Festival. I'm Cassie McCullough.
And I'm Kate Evans, delighted to be here on the lands of the Awakal, Bumbeban and Minjungbul people of the Bundjalung Nation, the traditional owners and original storytellers of this place.
And Kate, we're looking at a vast sea of beautiful faces who are coming out of a slight rain at this beautiful festival. It's really awful up here, isn't it?
Oh, it's just terrible. I mean, I walked beside an actual whale road yesterday and saw literally dozens of whales. So it's just lovely to be here. But we're here to talk books, reading, influences, to get all of us thinking about this year's Top 100 Australian Books Countdown. Voting will happen all through September, but how's it going to work, Cassie?
Look, you can choose 10 Australian books from any time. They can be fiction, non-fiction, science, history. There are crazy people who are talking about sort of submitting cookbooks. As someone who doesn't own any or has never read any, I won't be one of those. But you might be, so do it. And just get it in when the whole campaign starts. Don't do it now.
And we're talking 19th century, 20th century, 21st. I mean, really, we want to get a sense of the whole history of Australian writing and reading.
Mm, but it's good if it's been published and not just in your imagination. Now, we actually are going to get a little preview of some selections. We're going to have Radio National's very first mass show and tell. This is how it's going to work. We've put postcards in on your seats all around. You have them, hopefully, and you have a pen. Write down at least one, but up to five of your favourite Australian books and a as-yet unannounced famous Australian author may well read out your selection.
And it's great if you include the author as well as the title, because in the heat of the moment, we'll sometimes forget who's written what. But look, why don't we also meet our guests? So Claire Thomas is with us. She's written three novels, Fugitive Blue, The Performance, and her latest on Not Climbing Mountains. Hi, Claire.
Hello.
Great to see you, Claire. Also with us, Steve Minon, whose debut novel, First Name, Second Name, was shortlisted for this year's Miles Franklin Literary Award. And he's also written a children's book. What's that one called, Steve?
It's called Make Them Say Poo.
I already love it.
And journalist and novelist Trent Dalton is with us too. His latest and fourth novel is Gravity Let Me Go, but his 2018 debut novel Boy Swallows Universe topped last year's ABC's Top 100 Books of the 21st Century poll. Trent, g'day.
Hey, gang. Hey, Byron. So good to be here.
Now, we've asked you each to begin nominating books and to nominate and describe a book that matters to you. But beginning with a book from childhood, why don't you kick us off, Trent?
Well, I wanted to kick off with Storm Boy. Do we all remember? Remember Storm Boy? Yeah, yeah. Colin Tierley. Yeah, any teachers in the house? Yeah, God bless you. Miss Black, Brighton State School. Well, state school on the north side of Brisbane, Miss Black, you know, like I was just going through wild times, and she just, you know, it was a storm, and Miss Black came to me in year five and said, I think you'd really enjoy this book. And it was a book about, I love books about lonely kids, you know, like just kids who are a little bit isolated and isolated within themselves. And I saw this kid and his best friend was a pelican, and I had a Steeden football that was essentially Mr. Percival. And in Brighton and Brackenridge and Sandgate, if anyone knows those areas of Brisbane, there's these, yeah, represent, 4017. There are mud flats that extend as far as the eye can see at low tide. And I used to run along those mud flats with my Steeden football, pretending my football was Mr. Percival and I was the kid in Storm Boy. But most of all, the book is it's a father-son story, and I was being raised by my dad at that point, and the dad in that book has a few demons, and the dad in that book was the first time I sort of saw my dad in print. And the book was so special. Then I never forget, Miss Black said, well, guess where he lives, the guy who wrote that. So that book's set in like South Australia, but later in life, Colin Tierley moved to a place called Daybra. Yeah, if anyone knows Daybra. Oh, yeah. That's like half hour drive from Brackenridge where I grew up. And I could not believe that the man who created Storm Boy was a half hour drive from my crummy housing commission house. And it made me realise, like, oh, anyone's allowed to do this stuff, you know?
I'm so glad that you, yeah. I'm so glad that you've opened with Storm Boy, and I just instantly felt my chest compress because yeah. I think it was the first time I sobbed and sobbed reading a book.
Yeah,
it broke my heart. Oh. And then the film broke it again.
Yeah.
And it's still being studied. One of my children did it very recently at school, so, and had a similar effect.
Yeah.
What do you think, Claire? What is it like? What is it about? Is it that stuff
I think,
talking about?
As you say, the loneliness and the animal. I mean, who doesn't love the love relationship between a child and an animal? I mean, that is, and a pelican's an unusual one. Yeah. But and that sort of metaphor of flight and escape. I think all of that is beautiful in Storm Boy.
Yeah. Mm.
And so that novel was written in 1964, and it's also a novel about landscape and place.
Yeah.
But where do you want to take us, Claire Thomas? What's the book from your childhood?
I've got a couple from my childhood, but I'm going to go first of all with Hating Alison Ashley by Robin Klein. So I loved a lot of Robin Klein's books, but I've chosen this one. My memory of it, I was happy that it had a character, Alison Ashley, who had, you know, a blonde ponytail, nice posture, immaculate stationery, and a really complex inner life. And that was an unusual kind of representation of this very well-presenting kind of girl. So the main character in Hating Alison Ashley, her name is Erica Yerkin. Yuck, she gets called. And she's got a superiority complex. She thinks she's destined for great things, and she's trapped in her suburban school with she's too good for her family, she's too good for her classmates. And then Alison Ashley arrives, and they have this rivalry. And Erica Yerkin is very judgmental about everybody, but and she makes a lot of assumptions around Alison, who has what Robin Klein describes as a blossomy mask on her face. I love that image. And Erica assumes that behind the mask, she's a little snob and she's also looking down on people, but that doesn't prove to be the case. And their relationship plays out in this really satisfying way. And it kind of culminates in a play at a primary school camp, and there's questions of who's going to take the lead and who's going to be behind the scenes and all this kind of stuff around masks and performance and intimacy. I realised when I read it again, like, I'm still obsessed with that, and my novel, The Performance, has a lot of those themes, and I thought, oh, good God, maybe I found those initially partly through hating Alison Ashley, which was slightly mortifying but interesting too, that this question still interests me. So, yeah, hating Alison Ashley. And Erica Yerkin becomes a writer, which is also slightly funny because the other book from my childhood, which we will park for now, yeah, also is the main character of that becomes a writer. So I was kind of destined or doomed, depending on which way you want to look at it, in what I was interested in.
Thank you for that. That was great. That was a kind of book summary and a bit of self-psychoanalysis.
Yeah, at the same time. It's what I do.
But you describe that really beautifully, because I'm ashamed to say I've never read that book. I've heard its title for many years, and now I feel like it's what I need to chase down, probably for the same reasons you like it.
It's funny too. That's a thing that I really appreciate generally.
But I guess that's also the reason I love this top 100 countdown thing that we do, because we just start having conversations about books that we wouldn't have otherwise, and find out what people love. So,
and it takes us into so many different periods as well. So Storm Boy, 1964, Hating Alison Ashley, 1984. But Steve Minon, when and where? What are you going to offer up to?
I'm the oldest person on this panel, so I go back to 1918.
You're looking good.
But I was going to say, my childhood had a window of reading, and then it was sport after that. So my early childhood, I was really into reading, and everything after that was sport or school texts. Unfortunately, I don't have those sort of older teenage books to really refer to, but in my early childhood, I grew up in a small country town called Proserpine in far north Queensland. And in Proserpine, there was a little library, a little brick library that opened until 8 o'clock at night on a Tuesday or Wednesday night, I can't quite remember. But my parents used to take us in there dressed in our pyjamas to go and select a book. And in this tiny little library, there was a small children's picture book section, which I used to have to beat my sister to the Dr. Seuss section. Mm-hmm. But then they had this very odd little Australiana section, like it was some kind of niche. And so I do remember taking two books from that section. One was a strange book called The Coles Funny Picture Book. Oh, I don't know if anybody remembers that. Had a black cover and a rainbow graphic across it. And it was basically a sales tool for the book arcade in Melbourne, the Coles Book Arcade. But it was just full of Victoriana jokes and crazy, nutty stories and weird illustrations and things. And then beside that was The Magic Pudding.
Mm. Oh.
And I was fascinated by The Magic Pudding because it was such a strange story, and I couldn't quite put my handle on why I liked it. And looking back now, I think it was because it was very sarcastic, very ironic, or satirical, but I didn't read it that way when I was a child. I just read it as it, a child would, which is to take everything on face value. So it's a story of three friends. They're anthropomorphic Australian native animals. One's called Bunyip Blue Gum, and he's a koala-shaped creature. There's a guy called Barnacle Bill, who is a human. And then there's a slightly violent ex-mariner called Sam Sawnoff, and he's a penguin. And they have in their possession a pudding, which is an endlessly, it's a magic pudding because it replenishes itself after every meal. And the book is broken up into four sections called slice one, slice two, slice three, and slice four. And they go on this sort of journey together with the pudding, and then they are constantly burgled by these other characters. One is a wombat and one is a possum. And they're constantly having to get the pudding back from the possum. But there's this very strange, it's like an undertone of what possession actually is. And it made me think, and now as an adult, I reread it. It's available on the Gutenberg Library Project because it's now over 100 years old. And it made me think a lot differently about it, reading it as an adult, because it's like this story about Australia at, you know, very early period in Australia's development. It's a sort of sense of nationalism about it, but also there's this question about resources and whose resources are they, and whether they are endless resources. And there's also a weird section in it where they talk about this character called Curry and Rice. So there's a very sort of stereotypical Chinese character, and I'm half Chinese, so this pricked my ears up. And there's a scene in it where the penguin and Barnacle Bill decide to steal the pudding off this Curry and Rice character. And the way that it's described made me think that it was almost like some kind of a satirical look at the White Australia policy because of the way it worked, and also things like the Lambing Flat riots and those sorts of things which exist in Australian history and folklore. And I really started to look very sort of critically, I suppose, at the book at that point. But as a kid, it was about a magic pudding that kept replenishing itself. So, you know, it was wonderful in that respect.
Well, Steve, if I was interviewing PhD candidates, I'd have your name on the top of the list. I think you should write that.
Thank you, yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah. So can I just interrupt? Can we have someone do something about that crow? As soon as Trent Dolan started talking, a crow started going off.
All the time.
It's probably a bluebird, is it? Probably.
That's my crow. I'd nicknamed him Edgar.
All right, well, let's keep it down out there, mate.
Edgar, stop it.
Well, here on the bookshelf, we're talking important, influential, favourite books. At the rate we're going, we'll get through only about three more.
Yes.
But yeah. How about we get this quarter of the room to bring together their, I think Sarah's going to start collecting the postcards, and we'll give them to a writer who happens to be in the front row to make sense of it all. So that's what we're doing. We're talking influential Australian books. And, well, what about the idea of an Australian classic, Cassie McCullough?
Yeah, what makes a book an Australian classic? That's another PhD think about.
I'll try to keep the PhD shorter.
But let's go back to you, Trent Dolan, and just, you know, off the top of your head, an Australian classic that you'd include in your top 10.
Oh, I'd really love to. He might get mentioned a couple of times on this stage, but I'd love to just pay tribute to a beautiful man named David Malouf that we all lost. I'll say Jono, just hit me at oh, Matt, that's lovely. Like, imagine, you know, I'm sure he can hear you, you know, and like he touched people. Like, he genuinely, if you were in Brisbane and had anything to do with words or journalism, that guy, like, assisted you. Like, he's a stunning man, not just an author, but just a stunning man. And I've got this great moment where I let rip with this letter to David Malouf, who was so sort of cheeseball ambitious, and I sent it to him. And I just wanted to get it all out and go, hey, I read you at creative writing class at QUT, and you were like required reading, but you turned us all on to the ability to write about our own home city, as he did in Jono. And I just let rip with my thanks. And then he flippin' wrote back, yeah, like, what a guy. You know, you imagine how many chumps write to that guy, and handwritten letter, and he just said, keep going. You have the greatest thing any writer could ever wish for, a reader. Yeah.
So David Malouf is responsible for your career, is that what you're saying?
Pretty much, yeah. No, like, what if, though? Like, what if? Like, I was really into football books, you know, and comics and stuff, you know? Like, I really was. I was into the X-Men, you know, and then David Malouf comes along. But I'll let Claire speak more about him. A classic I love is Kenneth Cook, Wake in Fright.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just wild book. And the reason I love it reason I think it became a classic is because it spoke to a dark Australia that we're all aware of. And there's an aspect, I believe, of journalism in it, in that book, that just, like, I only read that book recently, so I'm not, like, it's not sort of stayed with me the way Malouf has, but it's, this book just speaks to me as a journalist. Because he writes how I've gone to so many, particularly Western Queensland towns, where you feel like you're in Wake in Fright.
Yeah.
Anyone been out west? Like, you know, and you're just like, I'm now in Wake in Fright.
And like, hello to all our listeners in Western Queensland.
This is on the radio, I forgot about. No, anyone out there would know what I'm talking about, though. Like, they would embrace that. It's that moment where you go to that sixth beer. You should never go to the sixth beer.
Okay, I'm writing that down.
Go home at five beers. The sixth beer, darkness lies beyond it. And I've had that moment where you go, am I about to end up going on a kangaroo hunt? And am I going to get clipped by a 303? And... yeah, it's just this most incredible sort of truth about how dark this country of ours can be.
So we've got Gothic Australian Fiction with Wake in Fright and a sort of semi-autobiographical novel from David Malouf in Jono. And Claire, I could see you sitting up straighter when we were talking about both David Malouf and the idea of an Australian classic.
Yeah, so I'm going to look, the Malouf pen pal story is pretty good. I can't really top that, but I do have we had a moment at school where we had to dress as a famous Australian, and it was just primary school. I don't know what the occasion was, but there was everyone came, you know, as sporty people or singers or movie stars or whatever, and my mum thought it would be a good idea if I went as 19th century Australian writer Henry Handel Richardson. which was the pen name for a woman, Ethel Florence Lindsay. I think the costume was easy. She kind of just put me in an ankle-length skirt, and I had some sort of messy updo and was holding a feather, and I was like, rider. Anyway, that was an interesting choice on her part, but I did... accept this suggestion from her because I had read her book, The Getting of Wisdom. And so I want to mention that as a very satisfying girl book. I went through a sort of girls in smocks genre, I think. You know, you're kind of Ruth Park and you Joan Lindsay, the Pinky Hang Rock is kind of a more elevated version of that. And then The Getting of Wisdom is a boarding school book, but the main character is... singular, like they all are. She's on the outside, and she does sort of acquire a little bit of wisdom, but not a heap.
Getting a little bit of wisdom.
Yeah. She gets incremental. The recently there was a re-release of The Getting of Wisdom, and her name was graffitied on the cover with, you know, an anarchist symbol. So her name's Laura Tweedle Rambotham, sets her up for a tough start. And I think an anarchist is overstating it, but she's a sort of inherently rebellious girl trying to work out what it is to have a woman's brain. And I remember reading that as a girl and just thinking, what is this notion of a woman's brain, the limitations of that, the parameters of that, what's acceptable, and whether, you know, there's anything of value, how much do you just disregard? And another thing I loved about The Getting of Wisdom was it was just one passionate girl friendship after another, which was my life experience, and just the dominance and the those relationships as the most formative. So that The Getting of Wisdom. But David Malouf, I did want to mention, although I was aware that I was going to be sitting with two Queenslanders, and I'm a Melburnian, that The Getting of Wisdom is very satisfyingly Melbourne. So that's my kind of representing there. So I wasn't surprised that David Malouf came up. But Flyaway Peter is the David Malouf book that I wanted to just briefly mention. I fretted a lot about this panel and making my choices, and I wanted to reread things, and a lot of things that I was considering didn't kind of pass the reread test. Like, and I had not wanted to read them again because I was worried about what my loving that book at that time might mean for me as an adult. Flyaway Peter, no, that was like absolutely passed the reread test. It was an absolute beauty from the first page, and it starts with a bird watcher in the grass, and then a photographer joins the scene. And it's straight away, Malouf is telling the reader to notice, pay attention, the idea of paying attention as a kind of moral choice. What do we put in the frame? What do we capture? What do we see? And all these questions of scale. And it's a book about men and war and birds, and I was not into any of those things as a teenager girl. And yet it's still captivated me then, and now it has again. And it's the man in the grass watching the birds at the beginning becomes a man in the trenches of World War One, and there's this amazing echo of the kind of earthliness and the human and the more than human, and all of that stuff is just so beautifully, perfectly evoked. And Malouf, for me, is the ultimate writer who provides clarity of prose, complexity of content, which I think is a sweet spot that I try to write to as well. So his sentences are just divine, perfect, like he's a poet. But then the layers and what you can get out of this, every sentence, every paragraph, every page, beautiful, beautiful writing. That was a rave. I'll stop now.
No, that was beautiful. Right. It was lovely. Right. Yeah. How did you go with the Henry Handel Richardson outfit?
Oh, it was a big hit.
Good.
Yeah, it was the feather. I really wheeled it with a certain, you know.
Yeah, the whole quill thing, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's, yes, I'm sorry if I
did. A little startling in 1910 for an Australian writer to be using one, but anyway. Yeah,
well, I didn't. It was just old, you know, yoldy.
And I promise we are very soon going to get to your
selections.
Hang on,
Kate, are you just picking up Claire Thomas on an anachronism in her costume from when she was a kid?
No,
on a book parade.
No, that would be her mum. That would be
I think
mom,
the
I'm
costume
the
was
there.
Tasty. I think that was the entire justification for it. So I think we won't quibble.
And also, I love a book parade. I think getting dressed up to celebrate books.
Who are you, Kate? Come on.
Well, no, see, we didn't really do it that much, but I love doing it for
we
my children.
We were on plinths. That's my memory. We weren't moving. We were sitting like sculptures, human sculptures with the feather, and the other kids were kind of moving around. So there was like, you know, Pat Cash. and Henry Handel Richardson. Well, it is so...
Bad catch.
I know. We contain multitudes in this Australian literary landscape.
Well, yeah. Here on the bookshelf on ABC Radio National, we know that we want to read books, not necessarily put them on plinths.
Yeah.
We do want to hear very soon about your selection in the room. But Steve Menon, Claire was talking about Fly Away Peter, which I think is a book that's often read for year 12.
Yes.
And there's a book that you read at the end of high school that could possibly be understood as an Australian classic. What was that?
Yeah, it was Thomas Keneally's The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith. Mm. Yeah, which was also an amazing film as well, very close to the book. And I had to read it as part of my year 12 text. Yeah, and so those of you who don't know the book, it's about, it's based on a true story, the life of Jimmy Governor. He's New South Wales, half white, half Aboriginal man who killed 9 Europeans, including 5 women, and then went on the run with his brother Joe. And he was eventually captured and he was executed or hung in Darlinghurst Jail, I think, in Sydney, in the year 1901. So the story is about him and his brother, and it's a story about rage and savagery, of course, because it's a terrible murder, and but it's also a story about race and there's this undercurrent throughout the whole thing about the birth of the nation as well. And so it's very sort of political. There's war mentioned in it a lot. It's set during the time of the Boer War. And so there's a lot of discussion amongst the white people about the Boers and whether they were going to go over and fight with the English or fight with the Boers. And so there was these contradictions. There was questions of national identity there. And then in amongst that, there's this character, Jimmy Blacksmith, who is, as I said, half European, half Aboriginal. And he's at war with himself because he's trying to lean toward his white side for acceptance. And yet his black side keeps coming back to him in through his relatives who keep trying to re-embrace him. And it's a very sort of sad descent into madness in the story. But for me, as a year 12 student, half Chinese, half Scottish, there were feelings in the book that I found incredibly profound, and they were describing things that I was struggling with. And I thought, I mean, a couple of the books on this list I've gone to because I have quite a personal connection to. So it's funny when you go back through a list and you try to put a list together of the top 100 books, you know, you want to apply your critical eye to it or your cultural eye, but it's very hard to distance your personal yourself from it and make those choices. And I think that's what books are so great at doing. They're able to help you connect with parts of yourself that you hadn't been able to articulate.
And that's the great pleasure of what's essentially a popular vote, is that everybody's making this decision in different ways. And yes, some people are wanting to think about influences. Some people are wanting to make grand claims about the nation. Other people are going, these are the books that made me weep or laugh or think. And so given that, let us put the author, Michael Winkler, author of Grimish and Grief Dog, on the spot right now. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Kate. Hi, Cassie. How are you?
We did just put Michael on the spot about this about 5 minutes before we started. Sorry.
Well, I'll jump in and say that we're getting a lot of love for Possum Magic by Mem Fox. Mm-hmm. The Narrow Road to the Deep North, Richard Flanagan. The Book Thief, Marcus Zusak.
Yes.
A few votes for Carpenteria by Alexis Wright, which is certainly in my top 10. Bookshelf favourite Hannah Kent, Burial Rights. A number of nominations for Tim Winton books, but with Cloud Street way out in front. and two former winners of the very important Mudd First Novel Prize, and they are Boy Swallows Universe, Brent Dalton, and Dictionary of Lost Words, Pip Williams.
Wow. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for bringing this together. And if people are willing to give up their postcards and bookmarks, we would love to take them away and look at them in detail afterwards and see what your selections are.
In the Radio National Laboratories.
Yes, under very, very scientific and precise circumstances. That's how we work, isn't it, Cassie?
Robin Williams is always down there fussing around with old beakers and stuff, and Norman stomping through.
Of course, we'll have to use our scientific colleagues to help us make sense of your decisions.
You're with ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. On air, on ABC Listen, or via your podcast catcher of choice, listening to a special live panel from the recent Byron Writers Festival, where we were joined by authors Trent Dalton, Claire Thomas, and Steve Minon, celebrating the Australian books that have influenced and stayed with them.
Now, let's see, do we have categories, or do we just want our dear friends on stage to just start throwing in their faves?
Let's go for the open mic section.
Take it away, Trent Dalton. I can see you reaching.
Really? Can I just riff like an idiot for a sec? This is my all-time favourite Australian book. It's called She Is Me. This is my number one. And it speaks to what you just said, Kate, what Steve said. This is the book that makes me weep more than anything. This book came out this year. It's a non-fiction book. The older I get, I just want to spend kind of the rest of my life getting stories from people who aren't writers. Sometimes the best stories can come from people who don't write and do it reluctantly and let rip with their story. This is a collection by Talia, is a First Nations criminologist from North Queensland. She spent time in prison for drug trafficking, drug possession. And she has gone around to prisons and just gotten women to just tell their stories. And here's my favourite passage of writing, if I can quickly get through it. I promise it won't take long. This is why this book. Mothers in prison find it. This is the introduction from a woman who did 3 years in prison, mother of four, was in 3 years in prison for heroin trafficking. Mothers in prison find it hard not to worry about the kids they are missing. They usually don't show it to those they are housed with, but trust me, it's there. Yes, this was my hardship during my time in prison. The missing was their father staying off the grog, working, looking after them. I felt certain that he would pass his deep-seated resentments on to them, that they would all end up being women haters. Yes, I know that my journey with drugs prior to incarceration would obviously have impaired me as a mum. It's true. But the boys were always my most important concern. I took them everywhere with me, all the good and, yes, the bad places. I loved them enormously. And for me, the hardest part of my incarceration was missing my sons. The hardest part is the missing, the self-flagellation, what you've done to bring this about, missing someone outside, blaming yourself for stuffing things up once again, getting caught, trusting the wrong person, thinking that just one time and it would be okay. But of course, it wasn't. You destroyed everything.
And so that book is called She Is Me, The Journey from Prison to Self, and it's by the criminologist and former prisoner, I think, Talia Isaac.
She, the woman who wrote that introduction is my mum.
Oh, yeah.
That's why that book's the best book in Australia.
You're going to make us all cry.
Sorry.
But non-fiction, Cassie, that's a really important part of this conversation, isn't it?
Well, you know, I guess I agree with you, Trent, that as I, you know, pass a few years, I do find the stories of truth as startling, if not more startling than the ones that we find in fiction. But, I think, I mean, are you happy to nominate one of those as well, Claire? A non-fiction? Have you got a non-fiction on your...
No, I'm a fiction devotee and I'm going to lock in.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I was actually going to bring up a third category. I was going to bring up a poetry collection. Drop Bear by Evelyn Araluen, which I think is one of the most significant and extraordinary books in recent years to be published in Australia. It won the Stella Prize in 2022, I think. Evelyn is an Indigenous woman, and I remember seeing her at poetry readings around Melbourne, and she would just pop. She'd get up and be like, "Who is this person?" And she was just, her facility with language, the searing kind of clarity of her expression, her presence, everything about it was just extraordinary. And then when the book came out, I was like, thank God, it met what I was hoping. And I cried when I read it. I laughed when I read it. When I reread it just recently, I put it down. I was like, damn, girl, like it's just virtuosic. And one of the things that she does is talk back to this genre of Australiana kids' books. So like Stephen mentioned, The Magic Pudding, she uses that as a kind of metaphor to consider the voracious colonial kind of eating of the land that never stops, and just this kind of this notion of an endless supply. And she makes tricky these sort of little cutesy Snugglepot and Cuddle Pie figures that we've all grown up with, and kind of unpacks them and brings them back to life in a more complex way. But also she recognises that everyone had those books. So I found Blinky Bill, Magic Pudding, Snugglepot and Cuddle Pie. My dad's had these gorgeous old hardbacks. They're on my bookshelves. And Evelyn writes poetry about her Indigenous parents also having those books, and that kind of the grappling with what you do with the inherited text. Drop Bear, Evelyn Araluen. And it's actually it's very readable as well for a poetry collection. So it is the kind of thing you can just, I won't spruik it any further, but read it if you haven't already.
I think Kate wants me to out myself and let you know that I went to my book parade as Cuddle Pie, so I'm right there. Yeah.
That's cute. Yeah, what did you wear? Like not much or?
Wow, that's an interesting thought for a different kind of parade. Actually, what I did was I got a palm frond and split it down the middle and tied it round my waist, and I wore a little beret.
Oh, yeah, perfect.
Just perfect. Steve Manon, as we're getting to the we have to talk about this, I don't want to leave this conversation without nominating X book. What's the next on your list?
I want to fly the flag for humour in Australian literature. I noticed up the back there Siang Lu was here, who wrote a very humorous book that won the Miles Franklin. I want to bring up this book, which is a Brisbane book. It's called Zigzag Street by Nick Earls. Yeah? And I really love this book, partly because I spent so many of my student years in Brisbane, and I lived in streets that were very near Zigzag Street. And when he writes in this book, he talks about actual restaurants and actual cafes and actual streets that you can almost do like a Hollywood tour of Zigzag Street book by going around Brisbane, particularly the suburb of Paddington. And it's about a guy called Richard Derrington, who is a classic self-deprecating and insecure man. And I think the self-deprecating, insecure man is a character that should be in more Australian fiction, because we do a lot of the alphas, and it's wonderful to read a book where the character is that insecure. It's kind of like a sad lad novel.
Sad lad.
Yeah, and he's sort of straight out of uni. He's a lawyer at this point, but he's mourning the loss of the girlfriend that he's had since uni, and he's trying to get his life back on track. And at the same time, he's trying to renovate his grandmother's Queenslander house, which he's inherited to live in for free. But it's very funny. And I love the self-deprecating humour. And once when I worked in advertising, I had to come up with a campaign for Brisbane, a tourism campaign for Brisbane. And it was at the time when Wally Lewis was supreme and sporting things were like the number one, always in the front of the paper.
The king.
And, yes, and Brisbane didn't have icons like Sydney has, like the Opera House or the bridge, and didn't have massive cultural institutions like Melbourne did. So what we were thinking of was what does Brisbane represent? And I think it's that self-deprecating sense of humour. And we made Nick Earls and author the face of Brisbane. For about 3 years, he fronted the ad campaigns for Brisbane. And I feel really proud about that.
You should be very
I feel like I've subverted somehow.
But that's also a lovely reminder of how much Australian books can take us into a very particular place,
yes.
A particular suburb, a country town. And that's something that we're hoping people might think about as they're selecting their own top 10 books. Do you want to select books that are your Brisbane or your Wollongong or yeah. your Dapto mm. or whatever it is that really resonates? And I can see, Claire, that's immediately got you thinking.
Yeah, because this whole concept of Australian literature, I find, you know, tricky.
Well, and you write your way out of Australia
yes,
in your own
absolutely.
Fiction.
Absolutely. And so, but it's a geography thing. And one of the, my favourite, you know, we're talking about a landmass. And one of my favourite parts of the Australian landmass is the Dandenongs outside Melbourne. And it is incredibly underrepresented in literature. Like there's almost, and my next book is set there. And so I've tried to read everything I can that's already been written there. There's very few books, but the final thing that my final offering is what I consider to be the best book that currently exists of the Dandenongs, and it's Brian Castro's The Garden Book. Mm. And it came out about 20 years ago. It's a very complicated novel. It does this incredible stuff with layering on the land, so it's and it evokes the specificity of the Dandenongs, the wetness and the beautiful tree, but also all the kind of human layers that have gone before. And it's really complicated and you have to concentrate. And I like that in a novel. And it's a big brain book and that's still a bit taboo, I think, in Australian literature sometimes. That's not meant to be something that we actually want is to have a hard time reading a book, but I don't mind that. So right. Brian Castro's The Garden Book.
Brian Castro, such an interesting experimental
yes.
kind of writer. Cassie, shall we put Michael Winkler on the spot
yeah.
again?
Let's do it. Michael, what are the people saying?
Well, the people are loving a lot of the ones that the people loved before. So a lot more of those ones. However, we're seeing a range of nominations for Helen Garner, but spread across a number of titles. After Claire spoke about Fly Away Peter, David Malouf has got a few votes, which is great. A couple of people mentioned A Fortunate Life, A.B. Facey, which was a publishing phenomenon in the 1980s. My Brilliant Career, The Thornbirds, Schindler's Ark, which was filmed as Schindler's List. A couple of votes for A Room Made of Leaves by Kate Grenville. And I will mention two nominations because they please me so much, and that is The Transit of Venus by Shirley Hazzard and The Vivisector by Patrick White. Oh, yeah. So a gold star to those people for getting it right.
Wow.
Correct answer.
and just a quick disclaimer, the books that have been selected today by our authors, they gave us extensive lists of books they love and they didn't get a chance to talk about them all. And I think, you know, it's just worth saying that there's a lot of broad and deep reading going on in this project. So thanks for really doing some hard thinking that may not have had a chance to shine here.
Yeah, well, if we were on an English game show, we would say this is time for a quick fire round with our guests, Trent Dalton, Steve Menon and Claire Thomas. So this is where you just get to name check them and maybe say one sentence each. Quick, Trent.
A Short History of Longans by Mirandi Riwo. Just beautiful structure. Every chapter that follows the chapter you just read informs the chapter you just read. Does that make any sense? That's how brilliant it is. It's really good. Mirandi Rewo, yeah, A Short History of Longguns.
Really terrific Chinese-Australian family structure.
Yep.
What do you want to throw onto the pile?
I will say The Children's Bark by Helen Garner.
which Steve Manon is holding in his hand.
Happens to have a copy.
Exquisite book. It didn't resonate for me when I first read it as a young person. I just thought it was meh. And then in older years, it's like the profundity was clearer.
And brings the dark heart of Australia to inner city Melbourne. Away from Western Queensland.
Is. Yeah. And obviously as a Melburnian woman, I had to, you know, represent Helen. Yeah.
Okay, Steve, you get to do another one.
The Lebs by Michael Muhammad Ahmed. An amazing book set in the time of the Twin Towers. And it's about a group of schoolboys in Punchbowl in Western Sydney who are trying to deal with newfound image of villains, and it's an incredible story about a struggle for a migrant group.
Mm-hmm. And so if you're sitting here in the audience thinking, none of those books were the books I would have nominated, what are these people thinking? Or if you're listening at home going, hang on, what about my favourites? What can these people do, Cassie McCullough?
Kate. They can look forward to the ABC Radio National Top 100 countdown of the greatest Australian books of all time. It's coming to a radio near you very soon. Voting will open, I think, about a month before the countdown.
31st of August.
Oh, yeah. I knew you'd get the details for me, Kate.
Five weeks you've got.
Oh, five, not four. Okay. Get writing down, post-it notes on the fridge, because I tell you, there's a lot of books you'll think, oh, what about that one? Oh, yeah. So you've got 10, which is actually, you know, going to be pretty hard. Start thinking.
Last hour of the last day is when I will put mine in. I know this to be true. And then on the weekend of the 17th and 18th of October, we'll broadcast the final results. But I guess first we should thank today's guests.
Yeah, thank you both, all three of you.
Our guests, of course, Trent Dalton, Steve Minon and Claire Thomas, with a special thank you for the man in the front row who we put on the spot as well, Michael Winkler.
Yes.
Yeah, Michael.
And don't be surprised if you see Michael's book, Grimish, on the top 100. Thanks, everyone. Really good to see you.
You've been listening to a special edition of The Bookshelf, recorded live at the Byron Writers Festival. Joining us on stage were writers Trent Dalton, Claire Thomas and Steve Manon, and with many thanks to the ambushed Michael Winkler, the author of Grimish and Grief Dog, who found himself rapidly reading postcards and notes in the midst of a large crowd. So now it's your turn, because voting for the Top 100 Australian Books Countdown opens on Monday, the 31st of August. So it's time to start planning your own top 10. Remember, there's a whole 5 weeks of voting, so you can really think about this. But think about fiction, history, science, picture books, the lot. There's a 1,000-strong inspiration list of books to help, but you can, of course, add your own selections too. And you can find all the details on the ABC Radio National website. Oh, and while you're there, there's also a survey we'd love you to do about the books programming on Radio National. But it's goodbye from the bookshelf for now. I'm Kate Evans, and we'll be back next time with regular reviewers Hannah Kent and Tom Wright to discuss the latest works from Sebastian Barry and Malcolm Knox, plus a new novel from the writer Melissa Harrison, whose book All Among the Barley was one of Cassie's favourites. I'm Kate Evans. See you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.